this week on the Inside Flap.
The most impressive part to me is that you got a cell signal there. I live in the middle of Los Angeles, right here where I'm sitting right now. Right. I don't have any cell signal.
Are you serious, really?
I'm serious,
wow.
Man.
Wow. L.A., you thought you knew all the depths of L.A.'s problems, but I didn't think cell service would have been one of them.
Yeah, right now, I am revealing the dark underbelly of Los Angeles.
Really?
No cell signal.
Hitting at the core of where we all live. No cell service.
But I did show it to all the other moms, and they had a really good laugh.
Oh, great. So he's doing a... And finally, it gets to the point where I'm like, all right, fine. Let me just respond. So I just write out, be ready to take that L. And then he comes back at me with, oh, Dave, that's all you got? Oh, I'm so disappointed in your smack. I would have figured you to be a legit smack talker. What's going on here? And I literally just, I'm running all around the school. Finally, I just write back, some of us have to work. That's like the only thing I could think of to say.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Sitting across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And one English bulldog length away from me to my left is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Excelsior. All of us back together again, finally, for episode 187 of ours and your favorite book podcast,
The Inside Flap.
It's great to be back all together after a couple of hectic weeks, and we got a great show for you today. We're joined by Robert Crace. He comes on. You know Robert Crace. He is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Elvis Cole books. He's got a new one out now featuring Joe Pike. It is called Racing the Light. It is really good. I enjoyed it. I love talking to Robert. I'm excited to bring that conversation to you in just a little bit, and we'll have that for you shortly. But first, it's been a busy couple weeks as we made the final push on getting our fall production up at East High School, and I got to give a shout out to Senior Conrad Branch, who wrote the production. It is called Red Ink. It is a murder mystery spinoff of Clue, and it is delightful. Andrew, you came and saw the play. Did you? You said you enjoyed it. Our friend Dave Thomas flew in all the way from Maryland. Of course, he was coming in for business, but he stopped by to see the play as well. He enjoyed it. Andrew, what did you think of the play?
So it was an amazing production. I mean, the set was impeccable, right? I mean, you know, there were things that opened and moved. You could interact with the set. The set was, you know, you were in the set.
Cool.
But I mean, the level of detail, you know, that Dave, of the people that Dave hired to put this set together.
cheap labor.
But no, I mean, just really spectacular. And then as far as performance, really some exceptional performers, really very entertaining for, you know, and it doesn't seem like Dave's school knows how to put on a short production. They all seem to be about like 3 hours.
I agree.
Yeah. This one runs at 2.5 hours. And I don't think they did a whole complete run through until the night before. So it wasn't like there was any time to cut anything out of it at that point.
Wow.
It is a good 2.5 hours, including intermission.
We are seeing it Saturday.
So you definitely get your money's worth.
My dad knows it's 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And he's like, I said it today. I was like, okay, so we're going to go in at 2:30. We'll get out at 5. And he goes, okay, and does that include the intermission?
It does include
the intermission.
Well, I'll make sure and reserve the seats because we populated the whole black box. And it was in the black box theater. We populated it all with old, because it's set in the 1800s in Victorian England.
I bet that was comfortable, right, Andrew?
So we populated the entire black box with chairs. I spent weeks running around to old furniture stores, Goodwills, Salvation Armies, and loading up the back of my truck, I don't know how many times, to fit 65 seats, old, with some of them with cane webbing, some with one chair arm broke, as I saw at the end of the play, And yeah, Andrew, how were they?
So a few things here. So one, I went to a Shakespeare production that was like 4 hours long.
Uh-huh.
And it was in these cheap chairs. And
was
so,
that at East High School?
So after the first hour, I couldn't feel my butt anymore.
Was that
at the end of 4 hours, I couldn't feel my ankles anymore.
Yeah. Those were the cushion chairs.
Yeah.
But these chairs were extremely comfortable.
You got lucky.
There's six chairs that are super comfortable.
Because I've seen those chairs and I thought, oh, that's just
don't worry. I will be reserving them for you, Felix, and your parents and Sylvia.
And I wouldn't worry about the runtime because it really doesn't feel like 2.5 hours.
Okay.
It's more like 3. Yeah.
Well, my dad sat through the 4 hour
extravaganza.
Shakespeare extravaganza. Mm. So he's a little nervous about the.
It goes pretty quick. Okay. And I tell you what is really impressive is it's the enthusiasm from the students with the production. Right. And also, you know, at the end of the performance, it was nice to be there for opening night.
I bet. Yeah. I bet. Good energy.
They did a little toast. Andrew and Dave got a big chuckle, I guess, right after the show when I came out and I was talking to Andrew and Dave.
Uh huh.
And they had this little, because it was, you know, Conrad, a student who wrote it, they had a little toast prepared with some sparkling cider. So they handed out little plastic shot glasses with sparkling cider. And I saw. As I'm standing there talking to Andrew and Dave, and Deb is getting ready to go walk up the staircase so she could look over everybody, and she gave a, Dave, let's go. Grab your juice and come with me.
Grab your juice.
And I saw Dave and Andrew start cracking up at the way she talked to me and the manner in which I responded.
Do you know why?
Why?
Because we're like, man, it's like Mary Medicus.
Yeah. I did snap to attention and said, I'm coming. I'm right there.
Grab your juice. Like you're 3. That's so funny.
And there.
Now, David.
Speaking of Mary Medicus, there she is. But yeah, there was a lot of work that went into that set. There's a hidden passages. There's a swinging bookcase, a fireplace that swings out, a hidden door in the wall, a safe behind a picture. A hell of a lot of work. We had to completely transform the Black Box Theater. We built 3 new walls, and these walls are 10 feet high, basically 20 feet long. Had to paint faux wallpaper using a stencil all over it. Had to populate the whole area with photo. That's a lot of wall to cover with stuff.
So that is actually faux wallpaper.
That's
faux wallpaper. Really looks like
it does,
real wallpaper.
It? Yeah.
It looks good.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know what I'll do? I'll post, check out theinsideflap.com and I'll post a picture or a little video I took, a 360 video of the actual set. So check that out.
Now, something else I would tell you is you could only fit like 70 people or so in the theater.
Yeah.
63.
But, you know, honestly felt very privileged to be there in the production.
Yeah, it's part of the whole experience. It's the immersive theater and the actors actually interact with some of the
I don't know if I've ever been to an immersive theater before. Have you, Dave?
Not really. Nothing like this. It was very cool.
I mean, I've been
special.
To Black Box, but it's still, they're separate. There's like a weird third wall or whatever you call
it.
Right.
No, this
wall?
Is everybody. Everybody feels a part of it because the actors use every inch of that space that isn't taken up by one of the old wicker chairs.
Now, do people sit on that couch that's in the spotlight?
Oh, that's one person gets to sit. Oh, no. That's the one. No, there's another couch that one person gets to sit on, but the actors use the 2 cushions around them. So it's like a privileged spot. Maybe I'll put your dad in that spot.
He might enjoy that.
He might enjoy that, right?
Yeah.
Oh man.
If nobody, they usually reserve that spot for teachers. If no teacher's there Saturday, let's put Tom
Lee. He's a former teacher.
In that spot. He is. Yeah. He is. Absolutely. So I'm going to request that Tom Lee gets that spot. So Tom, you've been warned. But I would like to take a second here just to let listeners out there know. Even for a show, and I was there the other night, and there was so much going on. I said, well, let me just start taking notes on my phone just to let the people know what exactly goes into it. The show had already been up for a couple of nights, so you'd think it'd be running smoothly. This is the kind of stuff that I dealt with. So the curtain is at 7. Call time is at 5, meaning my crew and the cast arrive at 5, and we've got 2 hours to get ready. So, and this is just a typical night. Okay, the other night. First of all, I get there, I find out one of the actors is, quote, not feeling well, so we have to start making plans for our student director to play Colonel Mustard. Then the actor who plays Mr. Body is telling me that her props are not where they're supposed to be during the show, and I have to go let my crew know to properly put the props where they're supposed to go. Then I got another kid in my crew telling me that I have to find our stage manager and this is the literal quote. The quote was, "Tell her to yell at the cast to get ready for fight call." I'm like, what do you mean tell her to yell at the cast? They're not listening to her. She needs to yell at them. So I need to yell at her to go tell them to yell at them. So that's kind of weird. The fireplace wasn't coming on. I had to figure out what was going on there.
Oh.
The parent volunteers were like, can you get the cash box? Can you get the cash box? But I'm just running from the black box to the auditorium, to my classroom, through the halls. I got Brandon asking me to open up the staff bathrooms. I got to grab the pie, and then I got to go get the key from Deb's office, grab the pie from Mrs. Lovett from Sweeney Todd, give that to the actress who's playing her. She starts bitching to me about her costume smelling
because
she spills a pie on her apron. And even though she's washing her costume,
it's the dairy.
It still smells.
It would be the dairy.
So she's bitching about that.
Gross.
I had a parent cuss out my volunteer, my parent. So I had one of the parents of cast members who was trying to get a ticket. Now, these tickets are a hot commodity. She couldn't. She said, this is the fourth effing night I've tried to get in here. She's yelling this to my parent volunteer who's working the ticket table.
Ooh.
And then apparently she starts yelling at a kid. So I had to deal with that situation. One of the sheaths for the sword on stage shattered the night before, and this was brought to my attention with 1 hour to go before curtain. I had to figure out a way to fix that. They're yelling at me that the iced tea in the whiskey container decanter, we needed more iced tea, and we needed more sparkling grape juice for the white wine.
Oh.
Mr. Body is bitching about all the blood, the fake blood on her costume sticking to her stomach, and how can I make a better pouch for her fake blood? I got to switch out the four photos that go on the walls and frames of Mrs. White and Mr. Body, because I took pictures of the actors playing those parts.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's different actors each night, I got to switch out the pictures every night. And I get my crew helping me with that too, but they're running around getting stuff ready as well, like getting the mattress outside of the window in place. We have scenes that take place outside. We got to get that. And then I'm dealing with all of this. My phone is getting blown up by our friend Mark, who all of a sudden he decides that he's going to start talking smack about an upcoming 5K that we've decided to turn up to run for.
That's funny.
And he's telling me how all this trash talk that's going on. And he's not only doing it just to me, but he's on the group thread.
Well, those are the worst.
I was at the school volunteering. I was a volunteer parent. I was helping serve. This was kind of weird. This is another story for another day. But I was helping serve these two guys their pasta meal that they had made. But my phone is getting blown up at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
By Mark talking trash to you, his wife, Wendy, and me on the group chat.
But I did show it to all the other moms, and they had a really good laugh.
Oh, great. So he's doing that. And finally, it gets to the point where I'm like, all right, fine. Let me just respond. Mm-hmm. So I just write out, be ready to take that L. And then he comes back at me with it. Oh, Dave, that's all you got? Oh, I'm so disappointed in your smack. I would have figured you to be a legit smack talker. What's going on here? And I literally just, I'm running all around the school. Finally, I just write back, some of us have to work. That's like the only thing I could think of to say.
The thing that he was doing then, though, I think, because all the other dads were doing it, he was loading the truck, a semi-truck,
that while he's working?
I believe so.
Mark, we need to chat. We need to sit down and chat. So he talks all this chat. Now, Mark's not even a runner, but he thinks he's going to beat me because he's, a cyclist. And he is a good cyclist, I guess. I don't know. I've never seen the guy race. He claims to have had some high finishes in some races.
He looks like he'd be a good cyclist.
He's very skinny. We'll say that. So, day of the race comes Sunday. I wake up 7 o'clock, get over the start line nice and early, get my number. 8 o'clock is the start time. 7:55, I leave my truck after breaking my Garmin watch. That's another story. Get over the start line. Oh, where's Mark? Oh, man, I don't know. He's nowhere to be found. I'm walking up and down the line. I don't see Mark anywhere. Now I'm thinking, because there's 1,000 people in the race, over 1,000 people run this 5K. And I'm thinking maybe the guy lined up in the back and he's just going to use his chip time. And, I'm thinking maybe he is a fast runner.
Question, though, did you really think he was going to run it? Well, because yeah. we had a very late night the night before.
Yeah, so did I. I had a very late night.
I'm we just all saying. Had,
but I. But remember, we put out a text. We said, "Listen, if you." Don't,
I called it. I said, "I'm not doing it." It was 12:30 a.m. I was like, hey, "Guys, I can't do
I
this."
I said, "Should we bag this 5K?" I never heard back.
Well, and let's face it. There's somebody we know that is a runner that. One could say he's passionate about running.
One could say.
And that is not your friend Mark.
No.
That is, you know what?
You don't talk a bunch of trash.
Oh,
anyway.
Sure you do.
Well,
I would agree with
that. This guy does. Hello, Mark. So I guess.
I think you would too, Dave.
So anyway, I run the race. I did great. I end up taking 18th place. And then I get back to my truck, pull out my phone, and there, of course, it's Mark. Oh, call me chicken if you want, but I couldn't get up in time. I slept in. And so I called him a chicken.
He unloaded the semi until like 1:30 in the morning.
All right. Yeah. Good for don't tug all this trash and then not show up on the day of the race.
I don't know what we were thinking though to do. Our daughter went to States and the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, which is a good 45 minutes away.
And well, we signed up for the race many weeks ago.
Yeah, but we knew the Air Force Academy was that night.
Yeah, but we never, it's not really something you're thinking about.
I thought about it. I didn't want to do it. Anyway, but that's me. I never really want to run, so.
Well, I did, and I'm here to say I now have bragging rights over Mark.
True.
So there you go. Laura, how has your week been?
Oh, it's been great. I took Sylvia to a music center that's right near us. In Littleton, and she had to get her
music store. We should say.
Music center
could be a lot of things.
Well, music center is in the title, and I maybe shouldn't say the title. I'm not going to malign them. But
okay.
Yeah. So she had to get her trombone fixed, and this is a trombone that has been to States, and Littleton got sixth place. Very exciting. But like now, she tells me like she can barely play it. Mm. And it's not working well.
Well, let's
she
give
needs
the,
to get
the,
it fixed.
The sad trombone for the trombone. There you go.
So we get in there, and the first guy looks like Garth from
Wayne and Garth,
Wayne's
like
World.
Dana Carvey from Wayne's
yes.
World.
Yes. Okay. So in other words, he looks like a guy that would be like at a guitar center
right.
to me, like a guitarist. He undoes the trombone and like tries to pick it up a little bit. It's clear to me and Sylvia, like this is a guy who's never touched a trombone in his life. Maybe has never touched a brass instrument other than to maybe set it on a shelf for someone to purchase.
All right.
Yeah. So
how old is this gentleman?
Oh, he's a teenager. Late teen.
Oh, okay,
late teen. Right, okay, late teen. Right. Early 20s, maybe. Mm-hmm. Like a young Garth. Young Garth.
Okay.
And so then he gets a guy from the back, and the guy from the back has a bow tie.
Oh, hey,
really
this guy's
friendly,
dressed to the nines.
Very like music nerdy. There's a certain type of nerd that's a music nerd.
Did like the bow tie have musical notes on it?
No, but I imagine he has one.
Sure,
of those.
He definitely has one.
Yeah, so this guy is super friendly, really helpful. He plays the violin, but he understands the trombone or whatever.
Was he wearing suspenders to go with the bow tie?
No, he's too young.
Oh, is he a young guy wearing a bow tie?
Oh, yeah.
How old is this guy?
Late 20s.
Really?
Early 30s.
Already got the bow tie game going.
Yes.
Short sleeve button-up shirt?
Long sleeve button-up.
Long sleeve button-up. Slacks? Khakis?
Oh, yeah, slacks.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So when you describe this guy initially, I'm picturing like the bald guy from Six Flags.
Oh, no, 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 no. This is a different type of music nerd that I'm not as familiar with because I'm familiar with the band nerds.
Right.
This is an orchestra nerd, I think, that we're dealing
with. Oh, okay.
Here.
This is a different breed.
This is
nerd.
A different breed. This breed is probably more highly intelligent, maybe more refined than your average band nerd.
Sophisticated.
More sophisticated.
Nerd. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hence the bow tie.
Hence the bow tie. But we get into it with this guy, and he starts telling me, like a roundabout story, he hiked the Appalachian Trail.
Okay, of course he did.
Yeah, not that long ago, and he hiked it with his pet rat.
Yeah. What?
Rat on his shoulder. But his point of telling me the story is Sylvia's boyfriend Felix was with us, and Felix plays the tuba, so we had told him, oh no, he plays the tuba, and his point was he met this guy who like lives under a bridge, seemingly lives under a bridge on the Appalachian
yeah,
Trail.
All kinds of types that hike that Appalachian
right?
Trail,
right? And this guy is like, oh, you're the first person I've ever seen hiking with a rat.
Shocker. I would hope so.
And then the guy goes further because he's like, I did see a guy hiking with his tuba once.
Oh.
There is a guy out there that hiked with his tuba the whole trail.
Come on.
And then our rat bow tie guy, he said he gets back home. His mom lives in Manhattan. His family is in Manhattan.
Do you think they're just doing this to like get in the Guinness Book of World Records? I feel like these are Guinness Book of World Records.
Oh, you know me.
Longest hike done with a rat.
It wasn't for this guy. It just was something he did. But the tuba, maybe. But his mom teaches music in New York. And she's like, oh, that's funny, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, you know, I have a friend of mine who has a student who hiked the whole trail with his tuba. It's the same. It's got to be the same guy. Isn't that wild, though?
That is crazy.
A guy under a bridge, and then he goes back to New York. I was surprised a guy in New York City would have a pet rat.
That's true. Usually people who live in New York hate rats.
Yes.
You're anti-rat.
And I forgot what he called it. He called it a fancy rat.
How do you keep the rat from not scurrying away when you're hiking or sleeping?
He said he would stay with him and he would have him on his shoulder and the rat would stay. But he also got a little worried because there's like birds of prey was starting to circle him above.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so then he has a little case, like a soft case.
Yeah, it's called the inside pocket on
his suit
coat.
That he would carry the rat with him because he was afraid a bird of prey was going to swoop down and grab his rat. And then he said, he's like...
What was the rat's name?
I don't know. You know what? Turn it. Oh, I didn't get it.
How could you not get the rats? You
got
to go
back.
Oh,
I even got what type of rat was.
I had to pick up the trombone.
You know what? I'll find out his name.
I think it was Ben. Was the rat.
It's got to be Ben the rat.
But then he's like, oh, but the great thing is at night, I could let the rat just run around my tent.
Oh, that's the great thing?
I know.
That's the great thing?
Right?
And crap all over the place.
Yes.
Oh, that's disgusting.
And run its tail over your face in the
now,
middle of the night.
Now, question about the tuba player. Did he play the tuba while hiking?
I don't know. We did not determine
that.
This is
another thing you need to find
out. But I'm going to assume at night he probably did.
Yeah, sitting around the old campfire blasting out. You know, that bass carries.
The deep bass. I know. Yeah. I bet he did.
It's like the Pied Tubist.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
Speaking of rats.
Yeah. So that was my story.
Wow.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. I've never heard of either one of those things.
I got to go into this place.
This guy was filled with interesting things.
How did he randomly start talking about? He just wants everyone to know he hiked the Appalachian Trail with a rat.
No, it was tuba. The tuba brought it up. And then he goes, oh, I have a funny story about a tuba. And he goes, well, let me back this story up and I'll tell you something about myself. Yeah. He's like, my mom would not want me to tell you this.
Don't go running screaming out the front door when I tell you this. But
yeah. And he said the only reason he got the rat was he was in a pet store and someone was going to buy a rat to feed to their snake.
Oh, so he.
And he said it was $4. And I thought, that's a cute rat. I'll get this rat.
Huh.
And it's a fancy rat, so I think it's like white
martyr.
And brown.
He's a rat martyr.
Yes.
See, here's the question. How did things end for the rat?
I know.
That's what I really want to know.
I am afraid to ask how things ended for the rat, but I would like to know the rat's name.
Because I'm sure it didn't end well.
I can't imagine that it did. You're running around the Appalachian Trail with a rat.
Or, you know, he was stuck for a couple days, and he got avalanched in, and he was hungry.
They make for a nice fried snack.
Oh gosh. I know. I gotta know the rat's name. I can't believe I don't know the rat's name.
In China they you can get rat on a stick. It's especially there.
I have seen it.
Yeah.
Yep. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Andrew, how have you been?
So good. I mean, busy. It's Halloween just ended. You know, we had a little boy in our neighborhood, Ethan, a fifth grader. We've known him since before kindergarten. And he basically, like, one day is going to a Major League Baseball game. The next day, his nose starts bleeding, and they find out he's got a very rare, aggressive form of cancer.
Wow.
But literally from one day to the next, like, he's fighting for his life.
Wow.
And so, you know, Halloween's a big holiday for us.
Oh, yeah.
We planned to do a haunted house or something. And so we decided to do a charity haunted yard. And so for 3 days, we set up, like, 50 different things. And for 3 days, my son, and I would say for the most part, like, he and I put everything together.
Yeah.
But he had, I'd say, six of his fifth grade classmates who were also good friends with Ethan. Mm-hmm. They also came and they helped to kind of like finalize things and to kind of run the scare.
Mm-hmm. They were the monsters, right?
Yeah, they were the monsters and stuff like that.
And you got all kinds of animatronics. We went over there and saw it, all kinds of animatronics.
It's creepy.
In the backyard as you walk.
It was very well
through
done.
Through the backyard. Yeah, really well done.
Now, the Medicus is just saw it at dusk.
We did.
And the darker it gets, the creepier it gets.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Andrew, I can't even imagine.
So the... You know, so we basically 3 nights, and like at the end of the second night, the kids were exhausted.
I bet.
And a few of the kids came back for Halloween. You know, so Peter basically gave up trick-or-treating to run the haunted yard.
Nice.
A couple other kids gave up half their trick-or-treating to come and run the haunted yard. But, you know, they've raised over $4,000.
Oh, wow.
Right, to give to them to help for, you
that's
know, help
great.
For medical
that's
costs.
Great. That'll really also. Help.
And, you know, I mean, so that's... That's kind of what we've been doing. Now, of course, I get home from work tonight. I'm looking for like the 90 minutes or so I get to relax before I have to come and record. And of course, I get home. It's like, yep, we're expecting snow. So you need to get out there and start packing that stuff up. You know, and it's just it's just how it goes. So, you know, tonight I'll probably be back there again in the yard picking stuff up tomorrow morning before work.
Yeah.
I'll be out there, you know, picking stuff up as well. So we had that going on. And then our oldest son, Dash, who's 13. You know, his teeth were perfect up until about a year ago when his 13-year-old molars started coming in and started pushing stuff all over the place.
You know what I've heard? I've heard if your teeth are perfect as a small child, it means they're too tight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there probably is truth to that.
Yeah.
So in any event, he needed to get braces.
Yeah.
So he got braces yesterday.
Oh.
And he is just, he was depressed ahead of getting the braces.
Yeah.
He, you know, to say he wasn't happy with the braces, and I think he got like clear braces.
Oh, did he?
Where you can barely like see the damn things. But, you know, still, so that's, you know, that was the, like, the trauma and the horror of basically getting braces. But
a lot of slam doors, a lot of stomping of the feet.
No, just him basically in his room and, you know.
So softly weeping.
Thinking his parents are evil monsters for making him get braces.
It's your fault now.
Yeah.
So, it's painful. They're so painful.
Katie especially feels like the worst mother in the world because Dash is really like putting her through the ringer like it's her fault.
He's lucky he's getting braces is what I would tell him.
Yeah, he should be thankful.
Yeah, he should be thankful. Yeah.
You know, what's $10,000 to $16,000 between friends, you know?
Yeah, he's lucky his parents can afford to give him that. That's for sure. Yeah.
So, but, you know, that's essentially that's what's been going on.
All right, very good. Well, we have a great guest for you today, joined by Robert Crace, the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Elvis Cole series. His new one out is called Racing the Light, and I really enjoyed this book, this new installment in the Elvis Cole series featuring Joe Pike. Now, I did enjoy this one, not just because part of the plot hinges on a crackpot podcaster, which is always great because I do consider myself to be somewhat of a crackpot podcaster. This is one who puts forth conspiracy theories that we just come out here and talk a little smack about our lives and tell you some book recommendations. This one finds the endearing and wisecracking gumshoe Elvis Cole take the case when this said podcaster goes missing. Seems like an easy case, but the more he dives into it, the more he finds out there's more than meets the eye, as it seems he's not the only one looking for this missing podcaster. Of course, he has to get his buddy and recurring character Joe Pike involved, and Racing the Light also sees a return of his estranged girlfriend Lucy and her son Ben, lending some deep emotionality to the story. This one has plenty of action, suspense, intrigue, and humor. Check it out. That is Racing the Light, and this is Robert Crace. I love LA. We love it. I love LA. We love it. We love it. But it is supposed to turn to snow, so hopefully we'll get our first snowfall of the year.
Hopefully here in Los Angeles we won't get any snow.
Let's hope not. Does it ever in there? It doesn't snow in LA, does it? Has it ever snowed in LA?
Yeah, actually, many, many years ago, it for a brief time, one early, late afternoon, we got a little tiny bit of snow, but it didn't, of course, I don't think it ever even hit the ground. Amazing, because I was home with my daughter, and we went out and we rushed outside. She was tiny then, and we were like, "Wow!" And I was like a little kid. Oh my! You know, it was fabulous. You never get that.
No, you don't. And it's fine when people know how to drive when it snows out here because it snows all the time. But I'm a little worried. I have to go to work after this. I'm a teacher, and I'm a little worried. They don't know. I have no idea how to drive in the rain. So I might have a tough.
Angelinos don't know how to drive in the rain. So
they don't know how to drive. Period. I mean, let's face
that's
it.
That's true too.
You're just crawling along the freeway. Anyway, Robert Craze, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I loved your new book, Racing the Light. Listen, this is a tale of UFOs, bees, a scarecrow, and a meatball. What was it that inspired you to write this latest chapter in the Elvis Cole and Joe Pike series?
Dave, honestly, this book, I think, grew out of the craziness that we've all lived through for these past years. You know, with the pandemic, and all the crazy things we were hearing on the news about the COVID and the pandemic, and you know, the conflicting reports as to its origins, and in the early days, it was like, wait, are we suddenly in this sort of we've awakened in a weird dystopian science fiction movie? Are we all going to die from this thing? Right?
Is it? It was scary.
Are we like? Right. It was scary. It was frightening. And I would watch TV. I would watch the news, and there's all these conflicting information about what was happening.
Yeah.
And you didn't know who to believe or who do you trust to be telling the truth. So that was going on, and I, unlike many. Many writers, a lot of my writer friends said, once the lockdowns began, they said, well, you know, I can't leave the house. So I'm writing more and more and more and more. I was just the opposite.
Right.
I just hit a wall and I couldn't write at all. And I was just glued to the news watching this thing unfold.
Us too.
Yeah. Concurrently with that, out of pun intended, out of the blue, the United States Navy releases videos of purported, you know, unidentified flying objects. Right. You know, not just some kook with his phone took it in a field somewhere. No. These films were taken by the United States Navy.
Right.
Which, by the way, they never explain. So there's that going on. And then here in Los Angeles, literally in the past 2 years now, 2.5 years, we've had 3 of our city councilmen indicted on corruption and bribery charges.
Oh, wow.
Two of which for accepting bribes that from foreign entities to influence the development of huge properties here in the city. And all of this stuff combined in me, all of it was like right at the forefront of my thoughts. And it drove home to me the notion of how important it is to be able to trust what you're told, how important it is to uncover the truth behind the lies we were being told. Life and death important. And out of that came a character named Josh Schumacher, who is a young podcaster who's easily dismissed because he's given to odd things like conspiracy theories and belief in Area 51, all kind of crazy stuff. But in my world, meaning the world of the books, Josh has come on to something that's actually real and true. He's made this discovery that is the truth behind the lies that government officials are telling us. And that puts him in great, great jeopardy. He disappears, and his mother hires Elvis Cole to find him.
Right.
And the story grows from there, man.
It's like, it's reminiscent of the old X-Files adage, the truth is out there. I don't know if you were an X-Files fan.
Exactly. I was a huge X-Files fan.
Okay.
But yeah, the truth is out there.
Yeah.
And then Mulder had this poster on his office wall.
Oh, yes.
Said,
believe.
Right? I want to believe.
That's it. Yeah. Are you a Mulder? Are you a Mulder or a Scully? Are you more of a Mulder guy? Or
I think I'm a Mulder guy. Yeah. Listen, I love Scully. I love them both.
Sure.
It was a great show.
Yeah.
But I think I always identified more with Mulder.
Yeah. Well, and then all of a sudden, Gillian Anderson turned British, I guess, because she couldn't do anything. But have you noticed that? Like, every role she took, she was doing her British accent. I'm like, was she British all along? I don't understand. But yeah, that was a great show, and I got echoes of that all throughout this book. And there's some alien talk in this book. You mentioned Area 51. We live here in Colorado. We took a drive down to Texas 1 year and went through Roswell. Have you ever been to Roswell?
I've never been to Roswell.
You got to get out to Roswell sometime.
I should make the pilgrimage, right?
You've got to. This is the town that aliens built. I mean, you can't go anywhere. You can't walk a block in this town without seeing a T-shirt shop full of aliens. They have a museum dedicated to the whole Roswell thing. It's just fascinating. It's a really fun place.
Sounds like a research trip I should make.
You need to. You can write it off. Come on, sure. Let's go. We need to see a sequel to this one. We dive a little bit more into that. And you're right. You know, you're talking about how, like, during the pandemic, and we were just getting bombarded by all this news, and we didn't know who to believe. I would get so angry. And just kind of internalized it. It's nice that you can take that and you have an outlet. You can write about it. Is that cathartic for you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
That's
yeah.
the word. It was very cathartic. Yeah. I've always used my books to try to make sense of things that troubled me or things I didn't understand. In and this is no exception. Mm. I actually was. The last book I had published was 3 years ago. It was called A Dangerous Man. And I had started, prior to that publication, I had started work on what was going to be my follow-up book. It wasn't this one. It was a different book.
Right.
But when all this stuff started happening, and I began to think more and more about the importance of uncovering the truth behind the lies, because someone's lying to us, right? If multiple people are presenting multiple information,
something don't add up.
So I literally abandoned that other project to write this book, because I needed to take, you know, in my head, right, I'm taking a stand for the importance of truth.
Yeah.
And also the importance of those people who are willing to risk everything to uncover the truth and share it with us. And I find that heroic. And that's who Josh Schumacher was to me. And you know, and that's why Elvis Cole's the hero too, because once Elvis discovers what Josh is up to, it becomes just as important to Elvis Cole to bring that truth public.
Yeah.
As it is to Josh, and together they form that duo who do this. So, you know, I wish I could do that in the real world, man. We need more Elvis Coles.
We do need more, but you write this stuff, people read it, and they, you know, hopefully you influence people to ask the same questions and try to dig deeper. And then it doesn't help when you had somebody up high who was obfuscating the truth, you know, deliberately. So, you know, you do what you got to do. We all do our little bit to move society forward, and hopefully the chips fall in a nice arrangement, I guess.
It appears to be a game of inches. All we can do is just keep shoving.
I like that. I want to put that on a T-shirt. Just keep shoving. Forget just do it. Just keep shoving. Now, speaking of chips, more food talk. You know, I always get hungry reading your books because you have just great. I appreciate the fact. Well, it's just, you know, it's so relatable when you have a guy who's going out there getting tacos all the time, or what have you. I think there's bagel talk in this book. What else you got? But like, it begs the question: are you a carnitas guy? Are you a chicken taco guy? What do you go with? What's your go-to taco out there in L.A.? You got some damn good tacos in L.A.
My go-to is carne asada.
Carne asada.
But right. I have to be honest with you. I'll eat damn near anything.
just like Elvis said. Yeah.
Elvis Cole, you know, Elvis Cole's a foodie because I'm a foodie. It has been that way. I love to cook.
Oh, do you?
I love to eat. Yeah. Hey, listen, you know, I spend all day sitting in front of my laptop typing. It's a very internalized, sedentary job. And it carries with it a certain amount of stress, right?
Because
I'm trying to get words done.
Yeah.
I find at the end of the day, cooking is enormously relaxing. Mm. It's creative. It's also very mechanical, right? The chopping, the cutting.
Yeah.
And so it relaxes me. It allows me to, you know, perhaps if I have a couple of cocktails too while I'm cooking, you know, that helps.
You got to. I mean, you have
got to, right? It's required. but my love for cooking shows up in Elvis Cold, and he loves food, and so I love writing those scenes.
That's great,
right? Where like in this book, he makes tacos. And he's driving around, he's getting the ingredients. You know, that's something I would do.
That's awesome.
So it's my way of transmogrifying myself into the character.
Nice.
And hopefully readers find it amusing.
Oh, I do. I know I do. But it does make me keep wanting to run to the kitchen or down to the little taco truck to get myself tacos. Do you have a favorite? Is Mexican food your go-to when you're cooking?
I cook a lot of Mexican food, but no, I cook anything. I'm from Louisiana.
Oh, so okay.
I cook a lot of Cajun stuff. Great, you know, the same stuff I ate when I was a kid back home.
Yeah.
I'll cook. It's all part of the adventure. I like to cook all kinds of things. I can do some Thai, Chinese, a lot of Italian, classic American. I got a smoker. I'm big on smoking meat.
I need an invite. Come on, what's going on?
we'll roll out the red carpet, man.
Got plenty of red carpets out there in LA. No shortage of red carpets for you.
Hey, don't blame me if your arteries clogged. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, I am blaming you. Now, one thing I found interesting in this book, there's mention of a safety. So, for certain characters might be going to a dangerous place, a place where there might be trouble, they notify someone before they go there. Now, I live here in Colorado. I do a lot of hiking, oftentimes by myself. I'm always texting my wife, let her know exactly where I'm going.
Sure.
And this is a great idea. More people need to be aware of this. If you don't know, you know, people think, well, anywhere I go, there's going to be cell phone service. I'm going to be fine. But, you know, stuff happens, as we've seen over the last number of years, no matter where you are, what can happen. Do you ever find yourself in a situation, you know, where you wished that you have let someone know where you were?
Well, I make a habit of letting people know where I'm going.
Yeah.
I mean, I hike early in the morning in the dark in canyons around Los Angeles. I do that for exercise
and
because I enjoy it.
Yeah.
So I always let my wife know, you know, here's where I'll be. Here's when to expect me back. Because you get up, you know, I'm in the middle of this enormous city surrounded by millions of people. And one of the wonderful things about Los Angeles is there are canyons along in the mountain range in here. And that are undeveloped, you know, they're state or national parkland.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go up in there, literally after a couple of curves in the trail, you see no one. It's as if you're in the middle of nowhere, even though you're surrounded by millions of people. But, you know, occasionally people fall, you know, the walls of the canyons can be steep. People fall, people get injured. They have to helicopter or rescue people. So I'm careful about letting people know where I'm going to be. And it's also, you know, you mentioned the word safety. It's also something that's done by people who work as prostitutes. I learned this a long time ago when I was researching another book, that oftentimes, you know, women who work in what's called the out call business.
Okay.
Yeah. Prostitutes who will go and meet someone
somewhere.
They let a friend know where they're going to be
in
case something bad happens. And I found that an interesting turn that I could use in the plot of this book.
Yeah.
And it made for, you know, it just makes for interesting complications and revelations on the part of Elvis Cole.
Do you see, when you're out hiking, you see characters like Jared out there, your homeless guy living in the canyon? Did you come across these
guys? I actually have.
Have you? Yeah.
I actually have. You know, Los Angeles has an enormous homeless population. And they're everywhere. But I have, in certain canyons where I hike, there are a couple of spots in those canyons, in the shadows, and little clearings where homeless people have gone up and they've set up camps.
Yeah.
Now here in the city, that's illegal because the parks are not, you're not supposed to have, but nevertheless they do for safety and other reasons.
Right.
So, you know, that got me to thinking about how those people came to be there, and the fact that they were there, it was obvious to me that one day they might witness something that would be relevant to a story.
They got nothing to do but to sit around and watch stuff. So they're going to see something. I like
and
that.
And by the way, if they saw something they shouldn't see, that would put them in great
danger. Exactly, yeah. And I like that character, Jared. And
he's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
I love him.
Yeah, he's a great guy. You know, I was hiking, I was doing a trail run out here in the foothills, and I come around the bend, and there was a guy who, there's a one mountain where a lot of paragliders come down. They do a lot of paragliding. Well, I guess something happened to whatever the thing is.
The parasail?
Yeah, and he fell. He dropped down a couple hundred feet, and he was in shock. He was bleeding, and he had his phone, and he was trying to call 911, and I had to, grab his phone and call 911 for him and wait there for the paramedics and just talk him down. It was crazy.
But, yeah. That is crazy. That is crazy. And what's the most impressive part to me is that you got a cell signal there.
That's true.
I live in the middle of Los Angeles, right here where I'm sitting right now.
Right.
I don't have any cell signal.
Are you serious, really?
I'm serious,
wow.
Man.
L.A., you thought you knew all the depths of L.A.'s problems, but I didn't think cell service would have been one of them.
Yeah, right now I am revealing the dark underbelly of Los Angeles.
Really?
No cell signal.
Hitting at the core of where we all live. No cell service.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. Now, listen, and Los Angeles is a big character in this one, a city of corruption, shady real estate dealings, murder, bad cell service. Is L.A. really as bad as you make it out to be? Even the Lakers haven't won a game yet. I was at the Nuggets game last night. It was great to root against the Lakers, although probably 25% of the crowd were Laker fans, but which made it even better to send them fleeing to the exits early. Is the L.A. this bad?
No, man.
Okay.
I love Los Angeles.
Okay.
Los Angeles is great, except I hate the traffic.
Yeah.
It's just one of the advantages of getting up. I don't sleep much, and I leave the house really early to do my hiking in the canyon.
Sure, yeah.
That's one of the great advantages of being out on the street at 4 a.m. is that the streets are empty. And you can drive all over the city the way you should be able to drive all over the city, right? It doesn't take much time. The traffic here is brutal. Brother, you don't want any part of this.
That's rough. Yeah, and there's nothing worse than just sitting and try. I get the rage, and I have to talk myself down out of the. You know what I mean? Because you just feel it boiling up, and you're like, okay, let me. I just got to breathe. Just got to do some little deep breathing exercises. Yeah. But
you don't want to be the road rage story on the evening news, right?
No, I mean, you don't want to be that
just
guy.
Throttle back, cool those jets.
Yeah, that's not good. Now, do you have any pets? I know Elvis likes to talk to his cat, a cat that hunts coyotes, by the way. Do you see a lot of coyotes on your hikes?
Oh, sure. I see coyotes on my street all the time, in the backyard. They're everywhere here.
You see mountain lions?
We have a couple of cats, but we don't let the cats outside.
You can't,
because of the coyotes. You can't.
Yeah.
If you let a house cat run in and out of your cat door or the window, whatever, it won't last three nights here.
Wow, yeah. Do you see any mountain lions out? Do you have mountain lions? We got a mountain.
We have mountain lions. Yeah. I've never seen one.
Yeah,
just not far from me in Griffith Park, which is a setting in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There is a famous, locally famous mountain lion named P-22. All the tagged mountain lions have numbers, right? And this one's P-22. He's lived in Griffith Park for about 10 years, and he walks all around the surrounding areas. He's always in the news, you know, because someone's home, like a Ring camera, right? Or
right.
Here's the mountain lion on our porch. Or here's the mountain lion walking by the street at 3 a.m. We see them all the time here. But they move all along the Santa Monica Mountains.
Right.
And unfortunately, they have to cross, occasionally, they have to cross a freeway. And then you can have a terrible situation there.
We've only seen one here, and thank God it was from the car. So that's where you want to see them. I'm sure I've done so many hikes. I'm sure they've been out there staring down at me, but luckily I've never.
That's the way I feel on my hikes. You know, I see coyotes all the time.
Right.
And then they never mess with me. No. They stay away. Yeah. I've never seen a big cat. I did see a bobcat once. Never seen a big cat. The thought is, you know, I know they move in those same hills. I know they move.
They're there. They're there.
Canyon. They're there. I just suspect that they're smart enough to stay away. They don't really want to mess with people.
No, they don't. There was a guy out here up in near Fort Collins who got attacked by a baby mountain lion, and he had to fight back, and he actually killed the mountain lion.
Oh,
yeah. It was just
serious.
A couple years ago. Yeah, he wrestled it and strangled the thing to death and then ran back. And, of course, the animal activist had to feel okay with that guy. But, I mean, you're fighting for your life there.
That's a different situation when something's trying to claw you and eat you. But, you know, I'll tell you, like, we're talking about these things and your friend will have, or that gentleman will have, of course, stories to tell.
Yeah.
I use all those encounters. That's the reality of Los Angeles, see? And I like to put the natural world in my books. You know, I will reference coyotes a lot. Red-tail, you know, Elvis Cole sees coyotes. He watches red-tail hawks float around above the canyon where he lives. Those things are part of the fabric of Los Angeles. Mm. So when I see the city itself as a character in the books.
Yeah.
So when I'm writing in my effort to bring that character, the character of the city to life, I like to use those things. I also think it's an interesting parallel, you know, because we are part of the wildlife too.
Right.
We may not think of ourselves as that way, but we are all part of the natural landscape.
Right.
And the natural landscape includes all these things. There's a wildness to all of us. And those are, I think, interesting components per crime novel.
That is true. That's a great point. We might be the wildest ones of them all. I love, you know who makes a return in this book? John Stone. How do you not love this guy? I had to laugh. That one scene where he's sending text messages to Elvis, I was slapping my knees several times at that book. That was really funny. That guy who will do anything for a Dodger ticket, is he fun to write for? You gotta have a ball writing for that guy, huh?
I love John Stone.
Yeah.
John Stone is my kind of character. Yeah. He's his own man. He's arrogant. He's a professional. He's a mercenary. He's a professional soldier with enormous experience in very elite operations, dangerous operations. He only cares about making a buck. Yeah. That is all he cares about.
Yeah.
He doesn't even like Elvis Cole.
No, I love the vitriol he has for Elvis.
I know.
He's great.
The only reason he's there is because he can make money off Joe Pye. And Joe Pike is Elvis Cole's friend, and Joe wants John to help.
Yeah.
So John's just doing it so he can stay good with Joe.
Yep.
Otherwise, he considers Elvis Cole an enormous waste of time.
So funny.
Yeah, it's funny. I can have fun with that.
Yeah, that's good. You got to. Now, listen, Robert Crace, it is time now for our segment we call Quick Six. These are six quick questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Bad Sisters.
Bad Sisters. What is that?
Bad Sisters. It's a British show. I think it's on Hulu. I could be wrong. I loved it. I loved it. It's a series, a 10 episode series about five sisters one of whom is married to an abuser, a horrible, horrible man. So the other four plot to kill him.
Oh,
it's terrific.
That sounds juicy. I love that. Okay, sounds good. So not about nuns then. Okay, I'll watch it. Great. All right, how about this? What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Elvis Gold's Los Angeles.
Hell yeah, you would. There you go.
I love the. Okay. I love it. I love the guys. Yeah. I wish Elvis Gold was here right now.
Yeah,
he's the guy. I would want him as my best friend.
Yeah, hell yeah, you would. Me too. How about this? Give me one of your top five favorite movies of all time.
The Godfather.
The Godfather, the original, the OG. Nice.
OG.
Can't go wrong with that one. How about a top five favorite book of yours?
Book of mine?
A book you've read. A favorite book you've read. Hard question.
Top five favorite books. Islands in the Stream. Burns everyone.
Oh, okay. Who wrote that one?
Ernest Hemingway.
I gotcha. You know, you say Islands in the Stream, I immediately think of the Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers song. But speaking of songs, here's our next question. What's your go-to, or do you have a go-to karaoke song?
No, I don't do karaoke.
Don't do karaoke.
All Bob, right. Don't do karaoke. That ain't happening.
All right. Yeah, and finally, what book are you currently reading?
I'm between books right now, but I'll tell you something I just read and dearly love. A novel by Lisa Scottolini called What Happened to the Bennetts.
I really
like that book. I thought it was terrific.
Great one. Well, listen, I thought your book was terrific, Racing the Light. And it's been a blast talking to you. I really appreciate you hopping on and spending some time swapping hiking stories with me.
We should do a guided tour.
I
had a blast, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Have a great day out there.
Okay, you too.
All right, I will.
Stay warm.
Yeah, I'll try. I'll try. Bye-bye. The Inside Flap. All right, there you go. That was Robert Crace. Thanks so much to him for hopping on. Check out that book. That is Racing the Light. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Where we are, I don't know where we are, but it will be.
All right, Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called Our Missing Hearts by Celeste Ng. She's the author of Little Fires Everywhere. Mm-hmm. They made it into a Netflix series. Andrew, I don't know if you saw it. You're looking at me like
what was it called?
Definitely haven't. Little Fires Everywhere.
Yeah, I've not.
Okay, then no. So,
what's the name of this one again?
Our Missing Hearts.
Ooh, that's a good title.
This is a really good title. Yeah. So this is a dystopian post-COVID novel.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely loved it. It's set in a future America that has embraced fascism and has also embraced the fear of the other, you know, in quotes. And the other.
Sounds scarily realistic. How far in the future are we here?
Probably 10 years if we have an economic collapse that we can't recover from with political violence and unrest.
Okay.
What? And the other in this book is anyone who's Asian. So a 12-year-old boy, his nickname is Bird. He lives with his father in an apartment. His father works at a big university library. And Bird's mother is a poet. She disappeared about 3 years ago. And in Bird's mind, you know, he's 12. She abandoned him and his father.
Right.
And he doesn't have good feelings toward her. He feels left behind.
Okay.
His mother is an Asian subversive poet. She's infamous. And she is wanted by the government also. And so
for espousing her shameful liberal poetry.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. For inciting, right?
Oh, yeah. Inciting, that's it, yes.
Yeah,
inciting.
That's what they say.
Sure.
So this government is obsessed with maintaining, quote, an American culture.
Yep.
So as they define it, right?
Okay.
Not as
right. You
or I might
Their
choose to define
of America.
It. Right.
And that's spelled Murica.
They monitor everyone. They have a policy in place that really encourages people to tell on each other. People will tell on their neighbors. Mm. their friends. Books are banned. And Asian people in particular are seen as the enemy. There's a lot of violence towards Asian people. If you don't have flags shown in your shop and you're Asian, people aren't going to come to you. You're going to run the risk of not being able to make any money. So in this America, the government takes children away from people that they see as un-American. And you guys know, like, our government and probably lots of governments, there's a long history of taking children away. Like, we took children away from Native Americans.
That's right, yep.
And, you know, there's other, at the border, you know, parents are being uh-huh. separated from their children. Like, yep. there's just a long history of it.
Yep.
And with slavery, you know, they'll separate families without yep. a second thought. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, that taking children away from people they see as un-American isn't, like, not that far-fetched at all.
No, it's not.
Far-fetched, I just
far-fetched.
Said.
Far-fetched.
Bless you to Andrew, who just had like 15 sneezes in a row.
I mean, the whole couch was shaking.
There's another one coming.
He looked at me so pleased because he didn't really make a sound.
No, he didn't.
He's like, you see, I did it.
I didn't even have to mute his microphone.
So one day, Bird gets a drawing in the mail. It's filled with cats. It's a page filled with cats. Andrew's going to sneeze again.
All right, ignore that.
Do you always sneeze silently or are you? No. Okay.
It's just simply.
You're very good at that.
I like to sneeze loud and let it all out.
Yeah, me too.
That's not polite.
No.
In a small
room. Not yeah. when we're
you're still very good at the quiet, full yeah. quiet.
Recording a podcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this drawing is filled with cats. Some it's hand-drawn cats, and he knows it's from his mother. He finds clues in this drawing, and he thinks that the clues are supposed to lead him to her. He starts talking to a librarian, and it turns out it's an underground group of librarians who are helping locate missing children.
Oh, Amy Del Poe would love this.
Yes, book. The children who were taken from their families. And he gets clues from these librarians as to where his mother might be. So for me, this page was an absolute page turner. I love the boy. I loved his father. I love just the quiet thoughtfulness of Bird. And any book that portrays librarians as... underground like subversive heroes.
Yeah, like superheroes.
Like you can't get past that. It's so good. Loved it. Celeste Ng, this writer also, a lot of people can do this maybe. I don't know. She does this better than most. She paints pictures with words.
Ah, okay.
I could picture this book in my head and visually, it's weird to say that a book is visually beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's visually beautiful.
Wow.
It was so interesting to me. The visuals that came to my mind that she described are absolutely incredible. Because people are fighting back in this America. We're not going to take it lying down, right? But they're fighting back in ways that are visually arresting.
That's wild.
And interesting. So I love this story. It's timely and exceptional. I don't always love the timely novels. This one, I think, is different. It doesn't... it's not depressing. Well, it is depressing, but ultimately it's uplifting.
Okay.
Very good. It's going to be on my best of list for 2022. Mm.
Wow. You heard it here first.
No, you know, it's an interesting concept. And the thing is, it really isn't as far-fetched.
No.
It's reality. And, you know, two examples. I lived in Germany and, you know.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And, but in any event,
before.
The Germans I talked to were like, you know, basically when stuff slid into, you know, Nazi Germany, it's like it just gradually happened.
It does.
And then it was too late.
Yeah, it happens without even realizing it.
That's so scary.
In hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, it's obvious now, but when you're sliding that direction,
you don't know.
You don't know, and then...
But you kind of do. But when you're not the one who is the target, you're like, okay, well, I'm going to keep doing my work.
This can't possibly happen.
I'm going to keep doing my job and doing my work, and you're busy, and you don't really think about it.
Well, and look at Russia. Right now, I mean, you basically have Putin in charge of this country.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the majority of people in Russia don't agree with him at all.
No.
I mean, they got people fleeing the country to get away, to basically get away from that too. But even like, you know, I mean, that's obviously a very oppressive regime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and who would have thought, you know, 20 years ago that they would revert back to that.
I know. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, so.
But this book is great.
Yeah, this book is great. It's timely. It's a great book club book. It's a great gift. It's a great book to read this year. It's called Our Missing Hearts.
Okay, and that is recommended by...
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week...
Dave Medicus. This is why we can't have nice things.
Is called The Max, and this is number 3 in the Max and Angela series by Ken Bruin, one of my favorites, Ken Bruin, and Jason Starr. Now, I've talked about Ken Bruin on the show before. I'm a huge fan of his Jack Taylor books, which I think are all done with now. There were 22 in that series.
Wow.
I love them so much.
Wow.
And when I saw, and was not familiar with this series, but I saw this book, and I hadn't read the first two. I read this one. I loved it. So it's not like you can read this one as a standalone, as I certainly did. I picked this up, and man, it had everything I was looking for. It is a hard-boiled noir with pitch black comedy. Everything I've come to expect from a Ken Bruin book, along with all the bizarre criminal underworld characters that populate his books. This is a witty, profane assault to the senses and sensibilities that is not for everyone. But if you like your books unapologetically nasty and yet also knee-slappingly funny, well, you're going to love this one. The story concerns this guy named Max, or the M-A-X, as he likes to call himself. Hmm. He is, by all accounts, he's a complete and total greaseball. He's a complete D-bag. He finds himself freshly imprisoned at Attica. And in fact, as he's getting ready to go into prison the week...
Where is Attica?
Upstate New York.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
As he's getting ready to go into Attica... He's like watching like prison movies and reading all these prison books.
Oh, that's healthy.
Yeah. Well, one of the great things that you get in every Ken Bruin book is he likes to, there's so many pop culture references. That's the great thing. And so many literary. This book has, so there's a character in this book who's an aspiring writer. And she has been told by her editors that true crime is where it's at now. So she's going after this guy, Max, to try to get the rights to his life story so she can write this story. And Max has a tremendous life story. And by all accounts, she thinks she's going to have a best-selling hit. But she's also a cokehead. And she's also obsessed with former guest and friend of the show, Laura Lippman.
Oh.
So the whole time she's imagining...
All of these things are very odd.
Yeah, she's imagining herself because... She likes the ladies, so she's imagining herself marrying and having Laura Lippman fall in love with her.
I mean, we were a little entranced with Laura Lippman.
I know.
I can see why you would be.
She even gets her hair cut to look like her and goes to see her at a book signing.
It all culminates
at this book signing.
So, Dave, in your research, did you find that Laura Lippman had any... like reviews or comments about this book?
No, and I really wish.
Is it Ken Bruin's ploy to meet Laura Lippman?
Maybe it is. Or Jason Starr, you know. I don't know. I really wish I had read this book before we talked to her. Because this book came out in 2006.
Oh,
but
it's
hilarious. He also, there's plenty of Megan Abbott references too.
We've talked to Megan Abbott too.
Yeah, but this writer who's fixated on telling this life, it's so funny.
That's really funny.
And Max is just this scumbag guy who is going to be like, you know, he's on the lower ranks when he enters the prison, and he's about to become his cellmate's you know what. But all of a sudden, a false rumor goes around that Max had, let's say he separated this guy's manhood from his body. So now all of a sudden, everybody's super scared of Max, even though he doesn't deserve, but now people are trying to curry favor with him. And, and he's got, it's just populated with these weird, eccentric prison characters. And then you have Angela, who also had dealings with Max in previous books. In this one, she's hanging around with a guy who thinks he's Tom Ripley from the Mr. Ripley books. But Angela, now she knows how to use a knife and is not afraid to. There's just so many, like I said, so many pop culture references, lots of humor. There's slapstick violence, lunatic prison characters. This is wacky. This is dark. It is violent. It is viciously profane. Pretty much everything I love in a book. This is The Max, and you better believe I'll be going back and reading the other books in this series as well. This is by Ken Bruin and Jason Starr. And it's a short one. Ken Bruin doesn't mince words. You know, he's from the old school, the noir school. Every word should have its own meaning. And you get that once again in this one. So If you're looking for something quick, something down and dirty, that's what this is. This is Down and Dirty. Check it out. The Max, recommended by me.
Dave Medicus.
Andrew.
Andrew. Down.
Don't stop, make it pop. DJ, blow my speakers up tonight.
What do you got for us this week?
See, Dave and Laura, do you know what premieres this week?
Oh, the Weird Al story.
Weird, the Al Yankovic story.
Yes.
Oh.
On the Roku channel.
Okay.
When does that come out?
I think
it's a movie, right?
I think it's a Thursday or Friday.
Cool. That's cool. With Radcliffe as the...
Daniel Radcliffe, yeah.
That's right.
Have you read any advanced reviews of it or anything?
You know, I listened to like the Jimmy Fallon interview and stuff like that. But, you know, there's all this hype and stuff ahead of something like this coming out. But is it really going to be as good as the hype? I mean...
With 47 reviews, it's coming in at a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
So, but any reviews ahead of the actual release?
Well, I mean, they would
audience gotten, the audience score is what matters.
Well, they would have gotten they're not going to give a review for something they haven't seen, so they would have gotten a.
Yeah, but I agree with Andrew. These days, sometimes critics prop up stuff, and you look, and it's like 97%, and then the audience is like 47.
And Rotten Tomato is especially suspect anymore.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they are biased.
Yeah,
this is true. Well,
they are.
Well, let's see where it is with the...
It's not like it used to be,
and they're biased because of the color of money. Which is a lead-in to the book I have to review this week.
Look at you. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I do just want to say before you get to it that the top critics, it doesn't give me the score, but they're all fresh except for 2 out of 15 with the top critics.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I still agree with Andrew.
Okay.
So my book this week is written by Walter Tevis, who has also written The Color of Money and The Hustler.
Okay. Paul Newman, right? Mm-hmm. Paul Newman, both of those?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he's, if you want to look him up, he's written some other books as well. But this book is a futuristic dystopia.
Oh. Right.
What's that? What is the name of it?
It is called Mockingbird.
Okay.
Mockingbird.
Bird.
I have a different Mockingbird song.
If that mockingbird don't sing.
That's the song I'm singing.
It's the exact same song.
I'm starting it out with the Carly Simon part.
Oh, yeah. Whatever. Mm-hmm.
Is that James Taylor?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So this book takes place about 300 years in the future. One of the main characters, his name is Paul. And Paul is basically an administrator of a university. And, you know, this book has sort of undertones of the movie Idiocracy. Like, I don't know if you've read the book or seen it.
Love that movie.
Idiocracy. And it's funny because when you look at Idiocracy, you know, there's just certain elements of that sadly ring true, right?
Yeah.
That we get dumber and dumber as, you know, as a society.
Right.
Absolutely.
And this book has a bit of that, but this book basically is that we've built a society that we're dependent on robots, we're dependent on automation, and basically... You know, and a lot of that has, because of that dependency, society has kind of gone off the rails. And in this book, it could potentially be the last generation of humans. And I'll basically get into that a little bit as well. And that's the thing is, you know, as it's science fiction, but it's
coming true.
Well, and that's the thing is, could this really happen?
Yeah, because you read about that guy who claims that there's certain AIs that have gone sentient.
And so I've heard that. I haven't researched it. You know, and
it's interesting.
And I could see, you know, I can see it happening, right?
It's interesting.
I think it probably is just a question of when.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, if humans can be sentient, why the hell can't computers be sentient?
That's right. That's right.
So, but as far as, you know, one of the characters, Paul, he's administrator. And, you know, you start to see things from his perspective. One of the other characters is Mary, and Mary is somebody that's living in the zoo, and every once in a while, Paul goes out to the zoo, he sees Mary, you know, he's looking at the zoo, because every once in a while, Paul, you know, he wants to think, and he wants to explore things. Now, one of the other main characters is Spoforth, and Spoforth is a Series 9, and he is the last Series 9 left, and the Series 9 was the ultimate robot. And all the Series 9 essentially went insane, and Spoforth is the last one left. And to a certain extent, Spoforth is pretty much running everything, because he is the smartest robot left alive.
Smartiest.
Yes. And so, we can patent that word. Trademark,
I think we
whatever.
Should. Yeah. Smartiest.
Yeah.
So, I kind of like it.
But, you know, and so what happens is humanity has made themselves 100% dependent on the robots to the point that they control everything. Right? I mean, there's nothing. And the humans work, but their working really has no purpose.
Mm.
You know, and I guess that's a question too. And so, you know, there's examples like this world is so dysfunctional. And I don't want to give away too many details for the book, but it's so dysfunctional that everybody is severely drugged. You start to feel a little agitated, pop some pills.
There's a pill for that.
Everybody's basically popping pills and smoking weed.
Oh.
There's no confrontation.
Interesting.
You know, but there's signs that everything's falling apart.
But no one cares.
Yeah, nobody, you know, and they can't care because of that. And then the other thing is they've also laced these pills with infertility drugs.
Oh.
So basically nobody can produce.
When was this book written, do you know?
1980.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So I wonder if this book's actually been made into...
Well, it hasn't, as I just looked him up, because get this... So many of his books has, including The Hustler, made into a movie. Of course, The Color of Money, made into a movie. The Man, he also wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth, which was a big movie with David Bowie.
I don't remember that. Bowie.
Bowie. But this guy also wrote The Queen's Gambit.
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
He wrote The Queen's Gambit.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So.
Someone needs to make this into a film.
Right.
And this book reads like it was just written.
It sounds right? like it.
So I don't know if they're re-releasing it, and that's how I found it.
I wonder.
So basically, I mean, this could be the last generation of humans. You know, if humans basically...
But now who's doing the infertility stuff in
well,
the...
Well, and that's the thing is, I mean, obviously the robots have something to do with it.
Oh.
And there's things in the book, like it kind of gets to like the reasoning of things. Mm. But, you know, everything's falling apart, but... Humans will set themselves on fire. You know, some of the robots might be suicidal, right? It's one of the things going in that. Now, you know, and humans don't even know how to read anymore. And so it's an interesting, you know, especially with the podcast and the show, is that Paul basically, he teaches himself to read. And then Paul teaches Mary to read. Now, Mary, because she's allergic to the medication... She's not taking the drugs. She's always awake and aware.
So she's feeling all the feels.
And she's smart.
Yeah.
And so when Paul meets her, there's something about her that he's attracted to. He's attracted to the fact that she's awake.
Yeah.
Right? That she's intelligent.
Hmm.
And there's something about Paul that Mary's attracted to. And so basically the two of them together, they kind of feed off of each other. But there's quotes, you know, and there's a place in the book. So what happens is Paul and Mary get separated. Like they live together and you're not supposed to cohabitate anymore.
Oh.
You know, you're not supposed to actually have like intimate sex with people anymore.
Hmm.
And if you get caught doing that by the robots, you'll be separated. And so
no intimate sex. You're going to have other kinds of
sex. Yeah. There's a quote, you know, quote in the book, quick sex is the best.
Oh, okay. All right.
So. And
we have our kicker for the show.
Yeah. And so Paul and Mary, basically, they form a relationship, right? And they don't really, and there's like no sense of family anymore, right? Mm. It's existence, but that's all it is existent. There's no meaning to it and everything. But there's a point in the book where Paul gets taken away. He gets taken away from Mary. He gets taken away from his library.
Mm.
And Paul basically is thinking about killing himself. And he realizes that what we all know is true is that life without reading is just not worth it.
Yeah.
That's true.
There's just no point.
Hmm.
You know, and so that's kind of like a fun quote with a book, but you know, that's how they discover knowledge is like they just learn how to read and then they discover caches of books and things.
Oh.
Right. And the books are there. It's just nobody,
no one knows how to deal.
Nobody
with
knows how to read anymore.
Wow.
And so, you know, and Paul is in a prison that's run by robots. You know, so he's got to basically figure out there are cults, you know, there are like religious cults and stuff in the book. But you know, it really is a very thought-provoking book. I think there's a lot that Walter Tevis is trying to say, with this book, but I, you know, I love this book. And when the book ends, it's one of those books where it's like, you know, maybe there's a sequel, but you know what? I'm happy if the story just ends right here.
Wow.
Right. And so,
well, I can tell you right now, there's no sequel.
Yeah. And the book is called Mockingbird by Walter Tevis.
Wow. It sounds really good.
It does sound good.
I wonder who he influenced also.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I bet it had a big influence on other sci-fi writers. Interesting.
Yep. That book is recommended by...
Is he still alive, babe, since you pulled him up?
No, he passed away in 1984, it looks
Oh,
like.
That's too bad. So we never got to see...
a long time ago, really.
Queen's Gambit.
Didn't get to see Queen's Gambit, but you know, got to see The Hustler.
That's true.
And I guess The Color of Money.
Color of Money.
I think the guy did all right.
Yeah, I mean, really a very original author. I mean, he didn't...
Yeah. Odd to have those are very different.
Not very formulaic in terms of what he was writing.
He's writing about chess, he's writing about pool, he's writing about robots.
Yeah, but those are hustlers, those two.
True.
Pool and the chess. She was a hustler.
Yep.
In a way.
Yeah.
Huh.
All right. Anyway, let's get on with it. It's time for the
Audiobook of the Week.
Audiobook of the Week. And this week I've got another, just what you wanted, another celebrity memoir. I gave you a Rob Lowe memoir not too long ago.
I don't think I know what this is.
You don't know what this is.
Because I haven't seen you. No.
You're going to be surprised at this one. As I was quite surprised by this one. And I don't know where I found this one. This came up, popped up on a list for me. And I was like, I'm not reading that. And then I read some of the reviews that other people said. I said, oh, maybe I will read this. And I started listening to it. I loved it. This is called Yours Cruelly, Elvira, Memoirs of the Mistress of the Dark. And is written and read by Cassandra Peterson.
Well, I keep hearing quotes from it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Well, I can see why. It's listen, she reads this book. She is a delight. Did you know that she performed with the Groundlings for many years?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so one of her closest friends is Paul Rubens.
Huh.
Who was Pee Wee Herman.
Was he Groundlings?
Yes, he was at the Groundlings as well. Also, she was in the Groundlings with Phil Hartman. She was friends with Phil Hartman.
Huh.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. So many...
I don't...
All I knew about her was Elvira.
I don't even know what Elvira is.
She's the Mistress of the Dark.
I know, but after that and the boobs, I have literally no idea what she does. Do you know what I mean?
Do you need to know more than that?
I mean, I guess I don't. You're right, I don't.
She
that's all I know.
She gained notoriety by hosting a syndicated... She would introduce horror movies for late night.
Is that
set.
All she did?
Late night. No, that's what she did in the Elvira. That's what Elvira did, yes. In her... Cassandra
Peterson.
But
is that how she became famous?
That's what she's known for. She, in the book, she was a Las Vegas showgirl by the age of 17.
Oh.
Illegally, by the way. Like, they hired her knowing that she was 17.
Oh, I see.
She became, she rocketed to fame very, very quickly.
I wonder why.
Well, certainly she would tell you that she had two main assets going for her.
Yeah.
That appeared very quickly on her body, and she put to good use.
Good for her, man.
She is not ashamed to tell you. And she's so funny. Lots of puns in this book.
Huh.
Clearly, she's got comedy chops. She, you know, is a member of the Groundlings. She made a couple of comedy movies. She actually, when she was 18 months old, there was a horrific accident as she was reaching for the stove or something, grabbed the pot of boiling water and had horrific burns over third degree burns over a third of her body and almost didn't make it. And grew up in a tough household, but she was like a groupie for bands. She would meet rock stars who came through town, all kinds of behind the scenes.
Was she ever addicted to drugs, or did she get hooked on anything?
Oh yeah, of course.
She did.
Lots of drugs and alcohol in this book, and she had to overcome that for sure.
How old is she now? Do you know?
I think she said she's 70.
Okay.
Book. She did it in a funny way. She's like, I'm 70. I might as well tell you. You can look it up online if you want, but I might as well go ahead and tell you.
Huh.
But she talks about she had run-ins with Frank Sinatra, Tom Jones, not good. They don't paint
those two guys don't have any good reputation, though. Jones. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, they're not very flattering portraits of then. But she also describes a night she spent with Elvis Presley. And she didn't spend it with him. She didn't go to bed with him or anything. But he gave her some incredible fatherly advice that she took to heart and really changed her life, which I thought was really fascinating.
Wonder which Elvis. Have you said
Elvis?
Well,
it was before all that.
Good-looking Elvis?
He was warning her about the dangers of drugs. She was a Vegas showgirl.
Oh.
And he's like talking to her seriously from the heart about how she needs to stay away from drugs. And ironically, you know, he went down that path. And she took his advice to heart and got out of Vegas and started a career in acting. And then, of course, went on to become Elvira, where she would, she and her writing partner would write, a guy from the Growlings, they would write like funny intros. And so when you're coming back from commercial, you know, you'd see Elvira and she'd
talk about the movies. I don't know if I ever saw her. If I did, I don't remember.
Yeah, I think as a kid, I probably looked in on it. It's probably, you know, because it would be on, you know, late Saturday night or whatever.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yes, Andrew's pulling up pictures of her on the phone. But she comes across as a very thoughtful and funny personality. And there's some really fascinating stuff about her personal life that it's all over. But she basically, she comes out in this book.
Yeah, that's what I had heard.
Right, yeah. That's what this book is. No, it's not really a spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Because I guess that's what it's known for. But yeah, she you know, well, you'll have to read the book and find out about what happens. Very enjoyable.
Does she have a good voice then?
Great voice. Yeah. Great voice. Mm. Absolutely. A great listening experience.
Mm. I had no idea.
Yep. All right. That'll do it for us this week. Thanks once again to Robert Crace for stopping by. Check out his book, Chasing the Light. Really, really good. Next installment of the Joe Pike series. Elvis Cole series, I should say, featuring Joe Pike. All right, my name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next time.
Adios.
Andrew Dowd, and let me say, next week we will have a fair and honest review of Weird, the Al Yankovic story.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to that.
An unbiased opinion. All right. Until then, see you later.
Quick sex is the best.